Blog Talk Radio.
And we will be discussing today the
the condition called bipolar disorder. Hi, Nadine, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you, David. This is wonderful to
be
here with you.
Good to have you, Nadine. Welcome on the show.
Well, I'm looking forward to our talk because I think that this is a topic that a lot of people are dealing with who may not even realize it. And so maybe we can help, bring some light to some dark areas that might just feel confusing and help people find out what they can do about it.
Right. Now, there are various stages of this condition, aren't there? So let's begin.
Okay. In bipolar, and it used to be called manic depressive disorder, so if you're hearing the word bipolar and you're thinking, well, that sounds a lot like manic depressive disorder, well, that's exactly right, because that's what it used to be called. Now, who used to call it that? Well, there's something that you'll hear me refer to, and you've probably heard others refer to, called the DSM-4R. Well, now they're coming out with the DSM-5. And all that stands for is a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And so anytime you go to a medical doctor or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or most any kind of mental health professional, they use this book, the DSM-4, or coming out the DSM-5, to make a diagnosis. Now, the diagnosis doesn't mean, in my opinion, that it's exactly right for that person, but it's as close as we can get. It's kind of like pointing to the moon with our elbow. You know, there's something going on with the person. There are certain definitions that go with this particular problem, and if they meet the definition or the criterion, then that's what they get diagnosed with. The whole issue of whether we should even be diagnosing people or labeling people is certainly one that I have had feelings about for many years. So I just want to say up front that I don't always agree with the diagnosis, but I will let you know what it is and where it comes from.
Okay, that's a very good point. Now, the first question that comes to mind is, in your observation, Nadine, how many people approximately would you say are diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
I was reading something earlier today, and it was talking about something like 4 million people in the United States. That is a huge number of people. Now, I'm trying to find that exact piece of information because I'd sure like to give you the most accurate information. As soon as I do, I will tell you. But this is the scary part about it. The scary part about it is that in the past, it tends to have been just adults. And in recent years, more and more children are getting a diagnosis of bipolar. That means that these children are starting to experience some real problems in their lives that are not necessarily due to something that's happened to them, but may have more to do with the family that they happen to be born into in terms of genetics or maybe some medication that they're on. So let me just start with telling you, what are the main symptoms of bipolar? Well, there's different labels or different titles, and one is called bipolar 1 disorder, one is called bipolar 2, another one is called cyclothymic disorder, and then there's substance-induced bipolar, and then bipolar disorder associated with a known general medical condition, and then other specified bipolar, and then unspecified. So all of those have a definition, and mostly we're going to just be focusing on the first three, which is bipolar 1, bipolar 2, and cyclothymic, because that's the one that most of us, I think, are concerned with and see in our daily lives.
Yeah.
So what is it that happens in bipolar? Well, typically we're looking at a cycle where a person goes into a manic or a hypomanic state. And I think most people understand the word manic or mania, and that's where they're moving too fast. If you look at, and I'm going to use a little example, may not be the best, but a little metaphor here. If you think about normal emotional life. You know, we go from happy and sad and everything in between. It's like walking and running. You know, sometimes we're running, we're feeling good, and other times we're walking, we're not quite as energetic, and sometimes we decide to stand still. Well, that would be a normal emotional flow, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have cyclothymia, which is a combination of the manic and the depressive, then it's kind of like you're in a plane like that goes up about as high as a crop duster. So if you think about a crop duster, it's going over the fields. You can see it. It's fairly close. It's pretty noisy, and it's making a ruckus. It's interfering with, you know, if you're trying to have some quiet time in the trees, it's interfering with it. But that would be an example of cyclothymia. But then you go way up above that to the jet stream, and you've got planes that are going super fast, and they're letting out these contrails that you can see for thousands of miles. So the effect of that super fast jet would be like bipolar 1 or even bipolar 2. What happens with the energy of the person when they get into a manic state is they're like that jet. They're going way faster than they would want to if they were in their normal way of being. Now, they may feel fantastic. I mean, think about it. If you're flying that high and you're going that fast. I mean, my son's a fighter pilot, and I understand. You know, he loves flying that fast. But if you're a normal person and you feel like your brain is going that fast and yet you're still here on the earth, you can see where that would be a problem. I'll stop in case you had a question about that.
Mel, do you have any questions?
Is that where the term cycling comes from? Is it from this term?
Yes,
in a
sense.
It looks like it's rude, a cycle.
Yes. It's well, the cycle is how frequently you move between this manic state and a depressed state. Now, not all bipolar includes depression, by the way. And I'll just go ahead and state that right now. The first one, bipolar 1, is only manic-y. In other words, the person goes into manic states and then they go back to normal. They go into manic states and then back to normal. Their manic states, however, are so severe that it disrupts the rest of their life. Now, how can a manic state be that severe? And by the way, that's the cycle. Goes into the manic and out of it, into it and out of it. That's the cycle. When a person is in a truly manic state, and I'm not talking about hypomanic, and I'm not talking about cyclothymia right now. I'm talking about the very first one, bipolar 1. They can become psychotic. If we go back to the jet analogy and you think about your brain is going so fast, you cannot grasp. It's kind of like going in a jet and trying to look at a flower outside.
Oh, wow, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, you can't do it. And you can't get hold of anything. And so your brain is just going fire. And it's usually going in a direction. But when I see a person, how do they look in the room? When I see a person who's unmedicated and they're bipolar 1 and they're in a manic state, they are talking so fast that it's like their brain is way ahead of their mouth. They can't get it out quickly enough. And they go from one thing to another thing to another thing. It's very, very hard. The word is track. It's very hard to track a conversation. And that's one of the symptoms of a manic
state. Is that where they use, like, the changing channels with the remote where it's, like, constantly changing?
Yes.
You know, what's on TV?
Yes. And, well, that's one of the things that could happen. Now, just because somebody sits there and changes channels doesn't mean that they have bipolar.
No, I mean figuratively, like, in their mind.
Yeah, in terms of,
like,
yes.
Yeah, channel surfing.
Like their mind is doing that. Well, let me, I think this might be a good time to talk about what is the definition of a manic episode, because we're beginning with that. And this is from the DSM 4R, and so this is like what would be called the Bible of psychiatrists and psychologists. This is what they look at to know if they're on target or not. Now, if you've listened to me on the show in the past, you'll know that I say, just because you hear something that sounds like you does not mean that you have it. because there are a lot of other potential. It's called hospital disease when we think we have everything that we hear, which is tongue-in-cheek. I can tell you, though, when I was in graduate school and learning about all these things, it's like, oh, gee, that sounds like something I felt, blah, 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 and, or that's something that my, you know. And now my daughter's in graduate school, and she's saying the same thing. She knew it was coming, though. She said, gee, I keep wondering about that.
Her predecessor serves her purpose there, right? At least she was prepared for it.
Yes, she
right?
was, because she had heard me say that. Yeah, I said, be careful. You're going to think you have everything that's there. And that's the truth of the matter is that as human beings, we do have a little bit of everything that's in that DSM. But it doesn't mean we have a disorder. It means we're a colorful, wonderful human being. That's all it means.
Right.
It's
right.
when it becomes a problem in our lives and it when it fits some pretty specific criteria or rules, that's when it becomes a diagnosable disorder.
Right.
So the first thing that a manic episode, a symptom of that, is a distinct period. It's not just any old time. You know when it's happening. A distinct period of abnormally and persistently elevated, expansive, or irritable mood that lasts at least a week. Now, just about everybody on the planet has a moment when they are just riding high, you know. Their mood is elevated or you're so excited or whatever. But imagine doing that every minute for a week. What does that mean to you? Well, for one thing, you probably won't sleep at all. And if you do, it'll just be maybe cat naps or maybe just 3 hours at the most, whatever. But it's very difficult. And then you become sleep deprived, which can add to it. So the first thing, and it's distinct, a distinct period of abnormally and persistently elevated, expansive, or irritable mood. So the elevated, we know, that means high, feeling high. Expansive is a little bit different mood. It's kind of like almost an all-knowing feeling. And you know, it's tricky, again, because you want to be careful when you're looking at these definitions that you don't apply them to somebody's spirituality. Because, in most spiritual traditions, it is quite acceptable to feel a love, for instance, for humanity or for nature, and that's not what I'm talking about. Okay.
Right.
Now, so we've got this elevated, expansive, or irritable mood. Now, that's the other thing. Not everybody feels like they're flying high when they're in this jet. Some people feel really irritable, and they'll snap your head off if you say anything or you look at them wrong. And it doesn't mean that you did anything.
Right.
And so one of the useful things about finding out about mental disorders or problems is sometimes it helps us when we experience it from others or from ourselves to get that, you know, that's not about me, is it?
Right.
You know, the way that that person reacted to something. And online, that happens a lot. I've noticed sometimes, and I've seen it happen in front of me, and it's funny at one level, but it's not funny at all. And I've seen it where one person will say something that, to me, looks like just a normal, nice thing to say, and somebody else will take it wrong, and then they'll blast back at them.
Yep.
And then the first person wonders, what in the heck happened? And so they come back on them. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. Sounds like every day on Facebook.
Not to me. No, I take the fifth on that, JT.
Well, I have
another
to
day on Facebook.
Yeah, I've seen it happen enough times. And I'm sitting there and I'm wondering, well, should I step in or should I just stay out of this one? Because it's almost as if you get into it with this person or whoever it is, if somebody is predisposed to feel irritable at that moment, now whether it's bipolar or whether it's some other reason, you know, if you step right into that, then you're likely to be the target.
which brings to mind a question for me, Nadine. When a person is in that state, and are these individuals suffering from, let's say, the manic phase, the expansive moods, like whether they be of self-righteousness, which I've seen in some, I'm a know-it-all, I know all things. Do they, are they able to distinguish between the personal and the professional? I mean, what's the relationship like between a person suffering from this, from this illness and, let's say, you, a therapist? What's it like?
Yeah, well, one of the things to keep in mind, and I'll sound like a broken record on this, is not to assume that they have a disorder. Some people are just grouchy. You know, some people are, you know, personality-wise, and I'm not talking about a personality disorder now, I'm just talking about personality. Some people are grouchier or more negative. I noticed somebody that I hadn't heard from in many years, and I was so delighted to run across this person online, and then I remembered why I hadn't had contact for all these years.
Yes, that's
because this person really doesn't want positives in their life.
Right.
You know, they, mm-hmm. they want to be able to grouch about things. But if we are really dealing with somebody who really does have a disorder and they meet all the other criteria that I'm still going to go over,
mm-hmm.
then yeah, it can be a symptom of the disorder that that they. It could either be that one, or it could be narcissistic personality disorder. When you
right.
mentioned that about this expansive, all-knowing kind of feeling,
mm-hmm.
sometimes when a person has narcissistic personality disorder, they have that attitude that I know more than everybody, and you know I'll be nice and let you talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's
yeah.
the thing. It's very tricky, and I want to you know, say a disclaimer right now, basically, that it is imperative. If you think that you recognize yourself or anybody else, please do not self-diagnose, and this is to anybody out there listening, because you really need to sit down in front of a licensed professional, not just somebody who thinks they know what they're talking about, you know, which a lot of people do these days because there's a lot of information. But
yeah.
somebody who has gone to a lot of trouble to really find out about it. Because if a person self-diagnoses themselves or someone else, especially if it's a child, and then they go in and maybe they say something to an overworked physician, family physician or psychiatrist, and this child or this person has such and such, they may get not only misdiagnosed, but they may be get treated
right.
with the wrong medication that could
mm-hmm.
kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's how serious it is. So when
yeah.
I say, yeah, it could be this, know that I'm saying it with a grain of salt, a big grain.
Right.
Okay, the second thing about a manic episode, so we've got the distinct period of abnormal and persistent elevated blah, blah, blah. Now, during the period of mood disturbance, so it is a mood disturbance. They're not normally feeling this way every minute, but all of a sudden, distinct change. During the period of mood disturbance, three or more of the following symptoms, and I'm going to list some symptoms here, have persisted and have been present to a significant degree. Okay, now this is where it gets more interesting, because just because somebody has the first one, it could be anything, you know, and you know, I could go through a litany of what it could possibly be, including nothing at all. But in addition to the first one, now we're looking at having four of these seven. Number one, inflated self-esteem or grandiosity. Now,
oh,
that's
really?
The one that you were referring to, and that I said that could also mean narcissistic personality. But that's one mm-hmm. of these seven. Number two, a decreased need for sleep. In other words, they feel rested after only 3 hours of sleep. Most of us, if we don't get enough sleep, you're going to hear about it.
Oh,
but a
yeah.
person who's in a manic state, they feel rested. So they're not complaining about not getting sleep. They just don't want to sleep. Okay, so that's number mm-hmm. two. Number three, they're more talkative than usual, or they feel a pressure to keep talking. How many of us have had a friend where we love them, but we're almost reluctant to get together because they don't know how to shut up?
Yeah, they'll talk you to death.
Yeah, they'll talk you to death. Now, there's a really good chance that either they have some manic stuff going on there, not necessarily from bipolar, but maybe from a medication or maybe from too much caffeine. But that's what I'm talking about. It's when the person is much more talkative than usual, or they feel a pressure to keep talking. So, for instance, I do group therapy because that's, I think, an effective way of getting people to really hear each other. And sometimes it's nice just to sit with the silence in between the people.
Yeah, they can't do silence.
Cannot do silence.
No.
You got it pegged there now.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, so that's number three.
They can't
number,
even do almost silence. Like,
right.
Like the time right before there could be silence, they can't even do that.
Right, and you know, one of the things that I talk about in my book that I'll mention later is there's a little piece in there where there's a family of First Nation people. Actually, they're in the South, so they would be called tribal people. And they're sitting there talking to each other, and there's a person from outside that's just observing. And what he observes is it's like taking a slow puff on a pipe, letting it out, and waiting before the next person speaks. And then the next person speaks, and it's kind of a nodding and understanding. And how wonderful that is to feel that kind of spaciousness in a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Where you don't feel like the person is so busy thinking about what
right.
they're going to say next, that so they're going to jump on your words.
Mm-hmm.
So when a person is in a manic state, they can't do that.
No.
Okay.
And I think society as a whole can't do that anymore, that everything's so fast forward that it, mm-hmm. it probably irritates the bipolar condition with all the stimulants.
It sure does. And even movies, if you look at old movies,
yep.
you see slower, you know, a little bit of time to develop the character. Now, boom,
yep.
boom, boom. Number four, flight of ideas or a subjective, meaning a very personal experience that their thoughts are racing. So this is not quite the same as the other ones that I've mentioned. The flight of ideas is like, I can't keep a thought in my head kind of a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking this, and all of a sudden I can't remember what I was just thinking about because now this is here and now this is here. Again, that's the kind of thing that could happen when somebody's just under a tremendous amount of stress and it just happens for a few minutes and then it's gone. I'm not talking about that. But it does give us an idea, doesn't it?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Of what that would feel like. Flight of ideas or the feeling that your thoughts are racing. Can't keep track. Like that jet's just gone and it's leaving you behind. Number five, distractibility. In other words, your attention is too easily drawn to unimportant or irrelevant external stimuli. So, for instance, you're trying to talk to somebody about something that's important, and they're just looking at this and looking at that, and you see their eyes glance somewhere else, and it's like they're totally distracted.
Right.
So that's what that one means, distractibility. Number six, an increase in goal-directed activity. Now, that sounds like an opposite, but actually they could both be true. An increase in goal-directed activity, either socially, at work, or school, or sexually, or a psychomotor agitation. What can you think of an example of what that might mean?
Say it again, so I want to make sure that I've got it clear.
Yeah, an increase in goal-directed activity, socially, at work, or school, or sexually. Goal-directed activity.
Now, are you talking like focus, like almost
yeah.
an OCD focus? Is that
yeah.
what you're
yeah.
getting?
It's
because
like always happen to be doing something.
Yeah, there's, oh yeah, but the creativity aspect of bipolar in itself is a piece that most people don't think about. But
mm-hmm.
that activating that mind and racing the mind must expose you to concepts and creativity that most people never would even think about. But
and you're getting on a,
yeah.
you're touching on a really important point that I want to talk about more with when we talk about cyclothymia, and that is
okay.
the creativity aspect. With this one, you're right. It can be creativity, but it could just be busy work. In other words, they always have to
right.
be doing something.
Right.
Oh, well, I can't do that for you now because I'm busy doing this. Oh, no, I can't talk to you now. I'm busy doing this. And so it's always doing something. And again, now that doesn't have to mean they have bipolar. It's
right.
one of these symptoms. And then number six. Oh, I'm sorry, seven.
So the ability to multitask with bipolar is pretty developed then, I would think.
Not with bipolar 1 or 2.
Oh, okay.
That's why I want to come back to it when we talk about cyclothymia.
Okay.
With bipolar 1 or 2, they're not multitasking. They're losing it. There's too many things. And the difference between a bipolar 1 or 2 and a cyclothymia is that the levels are so high, it's the jet stream, and it's like they're taking a jet in five directions at once. So they're not really multitasking. They're on the verge of psychosis.
Yeah.
So, for instance, if you look at something that person would normally be interested in, let's say they're normally a sexy person and they, you know, maybe they're single and they're interested in dating or whatever. Well, in a bipolar manic state, that person may become very promiscuous and take very, very high risks with their sexuality, unprotected sex with people they may not know and so forth, which they would never do under their normal circumstance, but in the manic episode they might do that. If they like to gamble, maybe they just like to use the nickel slot at a machine. During a manic episode, they'll gamble their whole mortgage or worse. And so it's real serious. It's not just a little bit. And then the last one, so you have to have four out of these seven that I've just been going over. The last one is excessive involvement in pleasurable activities that have a high potential for painful consequences. And that's actually what I was referring to just then with the sexuality. The pleasurable activities might include gambling, it might include drinking, it might include sex, it might include drugs, whatever it is, but the person overdoes it to such an extreme that they are almost certainly going to have painful consequences as a result.
Okay.
They may lose their family, their home, their spouse, their self-esteem, their standing in the community, et cetera.
So it's impulse-driven completely.
It's just, and they can't stop themselves in that state.
So no ability to stop the repercussions that will happen from it.
No regulation at all of that very strong manic thing.
That's got to be horrible to live in.
Yeah. So far for manic episode, we looked at a distinct period of abnormally and persistently elevated, et cetera, mood. B, during the period of the mood disturbance, there has to be three or four of those seven. Now, C, we're not through yet. The symptoms do not meet the criteria for a mixed episode, which means you have manic and depression, because bipolar 1 is only mania. And then D, the mood disturbance is sufficiently severe to cause marked impairment in occupational functioning. So, in other words, your job is at risk, or usual social activities or relationships with others, or to necessitate hospitalization to prevent harm to self or others. Now, many cases when somebody is in such a manic state, there was a wonderful movie some years ago that I used to show to my college classes. It was a perfect example of the manic state, and it was called Mr. Jones. Have you ever seen that?
It's an
oldie.
That.
If if you're listening to this and want a really good example of how bipolar 1 may look, although in the film he goes on to actually have bipolar 2 from the depressed end, but at the very beginning, this man, he's so high and he's wonderful, he's charming and everybody loves him, and he talks his way into a job that they didn't even have open. And as a construction worker, and he ends up on the top of his house hammering nails, and he's so high, it's like he wants to get higher, and he stands on the pointed part of the top of the house, and he starts walking out. Now, that's every one of these symptoms practically in that act.
Mm.
Because to fall would mean he would almost certainly kill himself. He's way up top. And that's one of the things that happens. So anyway, if you haven't seen that movie, it's a good one for this. And so it's sufficiently severe to cause marked impairment. Now, clearly he lost the job, but he also, by doing that, other men around him who thought he was kind of cool at first, they'd see that he was really not. You know, that he was doing something quite dangerous. And then the last one, the symptoms are not due to the direct physiological effects of a substance, in other words, some kind of medication or drug. And they're not due to a general medical condition like hyperthyroid. So that's, you know, that's kind of takes a manic-y kind of thing just to talk about all that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's something I'd like to reiterate, the disclaimer. This is the reason why it is so dangerous for anyone to self-diagnose.
Yes.
Because
right.
as we're discussing bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, they almost, if our listeners remember another show that we did on borderline personality,
mm-hmm.
a lot of these symptoms mirror the same symptomology as borderline disorder.
Exactly.
But it's dangerous to say, oh, my God, I need some lithium. Or, you know, or say, oh, I must be a borderline, because they seem to mirror each other, and that's why it's important to reiterate, my friends, listening to the show, we must never, ever self-diagnose or diagnose, especially diagnose someone else. And
yes.
I just wanted to throw that back out again.
Thank you so much, David, especially because so many more children have been diagnosed with bipolar in recent years. Now, one of the things that you may remember from a couple of shows back when I spoke on post-traumatic stress disorder, some of the children that were being diagnosed with bipolar because they couldn't sit in their or ADHD, excuse me, they were being incorrectly diagnosed when, in fact, they may have had post-traumatic stress disorder. And the reason I said that was because in children, depression does not look the same as it does in adults.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a young child, a child who's depressed may not be able to focus, may get up a lot, may talk, may do all kinds of stuff that's nothing like a depressed adult who just wants to hang out in bed, you know.
Okay.
And so that's one reason that it's really makes me a little nervous to think that there are maybe parents or teachers out there who have done this and are doing this and who are saying, oh, this child has ADHD or this child has bipolar, when in fact they don't. But then they get diagnosed. As I said, there are a lot of overworked doctors out there who,
right.
you know, don't have, you know, they get paid for 7 minutes. And if they don't get that diagnosis done then, and I've actually known of some doctors who had to pay back the insurance company if they took too long. I mean, that's
oh,
how
wow.
bad it is. And so
wow.
these doctors, you know, they're good people. You know, it's not like they're trying to hurt anybody, but sometimes they will give a diagnosis based on what somebody else has said that they think it is, and they'll say this, that they got off the Internet. And then the doctor will say, well, sounds like it to me, give them the wrong drug. And then the child reacts to the drug. Now, that can be an adult, too, but it's worse in children.
Right.
And so what do? Instead of taking the child off the drug, they give them another drug.
When they were to counteract the
mm-hmm.
side effects of that one medication, as they do in a lot of cases of bipolar, where they prescribe one thing and they say, well, we've got to give you this in order to counteract this, and then we have to give you this to counteract that. And, you know, quite personally, I find ADHD almost to be a hate crime,
mm-hmm.
which segues into another question that I have for you, Nadine.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about gender for a second. When you see these symptoms, is there any marked difference between a man and a woman and the percentages between the two genders and who suffers from this illness?
You know, I don't have that in front of me. I can tell you that in years past it would have been more likely to see a woman suffering from depression, and I have some good stats on that. But I don't
right.
have on the manic side, and I wouldn't want to mislead you. But in terms of the depressive side, which is what I'm going to talk about next, women are about four times as likely to threaten suicide and to maybe even attempt suicide, but men are four times as likely to be successful in killing themselves.
Mm.
Now, some people might think, well, what is the reason for that, because women just call wolf more? No, actually it isn't. The reason generally has to do for the method of suicide. And when we're talking about bipolar, we are definitely talking about the possibility of suicide or homicide. And so, men are more likely to use a weapon of choice would be a gun, for instance. And when you put a gun up to your head and you pull the trigger, chances are you're not going to make it.
Right.
A woman, on the other hand, is more likely to use pills.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a window of opportunity if somebody finds her that she might be able to have her stomach pumped and she'll get through it. So it's not so much the that women or men are calling out more, but that the choice of weapon is different. And so in terms of mania or who becomes most manicky, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess as to, but I'm going to hazard a guess anyway. I haven't seen, in my own experience, I haven't seen one more than the other.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. I would have guessed about the same, because I guess it's also a matter of manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
Where, let's face it, you know, men and women are both human beings, but there are chemical, hormonal, and physiological differences that pretty much establish different manifestations. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, and actually, one of the things that brought to mind in terms of gender. Now, this goes back a number of years, but it's still true in some places. Girls and boys. Let's talk about young teens. Girls would be more likely to be arrested for acting out. You know, for instance, if they were having a manic episode and having promiscuous sex, a girl would be more likely to be arrested for that or for running away than a boy would of the same age. Now, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, this day and age that people understand that there are a lot more similarities and that girls don't need to be arrested any more than boys, and maybe arresting them is not the answer anyway.
Right.
But I was reading someplace just the other day that it's still happening in so many places, not as much in this country, in the United States, all over, but it is in certain pockets where recently somebody was accused. They pulled a judge off the bench because a woman was accused of, and I know we're getting off topic here, but she was accused of dressing in a certain way that brought on a rape. And you know, that would automatically make most caring people upset because, you know,
yes.
That would be as if we're saying, well, it's all on the shoulders of the victim, you know, whether or not they get raped. Bringing it back to bipolar, though, because bipolar does have a sexual component, you know, that's one of the pieces, then there have definitely been people that have gotten in trouble for that were untreated. Now, I don't know if I'm even getting close to what you were asking, David.
Actually, you are. Because it is hard to guess. In what I've observed, not that I've ever needed therapy, mind you, but you know, it is something that I've noticed. And I think sometimes we had a very sad case of a teacher. He was a gym teacher, and everybody loved him, and apparently, one day he decided to go to a town an hour away and laid himself out on the train track and let a train take him out.
Oh, dear.
He committed suicide that way. And one thing that you had said in one of the shows, and once again, this is something that we really need to reiterate. If somebody threatens suicide, don't joke it off.
Absolutely.
Don't say, oh, here you go again. Don't poo-poo it. Don't ignore it. Keep an eye. Watch out. They need help. You got to be ready to call for help. Now, you did answer my question because this man had said nothing at all. So there was no manifestation. So in a way, you did answer the question. I don't think it's a matter of knowing the percentages between men and women, but rather who shows it.
Yeah.
The one that cries out for help, and which is something we all need to do when we need it, and many of us don't.
Well, what I think it might be a good time to do right now is to go over some of the symptoms of depression, because if you are seeing these symptoms in a person, and I'm hearing that that man wasn't showing them, and I agree, there are some people who you have no clue, and then all of a sudden they take their lives, and it's like, what happened? How did I miss that? And that can happen. Generally, though, more frequently, you will see some symptoms. And so let me just go over some of those, what they are. In order to have a major depressive disorder, and as I said on another show, we'll talk about this more, but just in terms of what a depressive disorder would look like, a single episode. You have to know that it's not better accounted for by something else that's going on with the person. Now, I'm not going to get into the names of all the other disorders that it could be, but there are other disorders that it could be. And so you have to know that that's not going on. So if I see somebody in my office and they've been sent to me because they're exhibiting depressive symptoms, then I want to ask them about some of these other things, and or at least observe and see if, as much as I can find out to make sure that there isn't something else that's causing it. Once that's determined that it's unlikely that anything else is causing it, then you have to look at, if we're only talking about depression, has there ever been a manic episode? And sometimes, like with the teacher, I don't know anything about the teacher, but sometimes there'll be somebody that everybody loves because they're so energetic and so pleasing, so good-natured.
Life of the party.
Yeah, and those kinds of words will be used to describe them, and they, how can they do so much, and they're always busy. Well, what you may be looking at is hypomania. It's not the kind of mania that is the jet stream flying, but it's the one where you're going faster than a normal, you know, running and walking cycle. You're up there on the crop duster, and there's a sense that life is kind of spinning out of control, but you're not psychotic, but it's just out of control. And if a person is having, you know, the manic or hypomanic, which is not the extreme version of the mania, but a lesser version, still not normal, but it's not as extreme, and they're having the depressive symptoms, then that third disorder is cyclothymia, and it's kind of like a roller coaster of emotion, not the most extreme, not the one where you turn upside down and go flippity flop, you know, and all that. I don't know what the names of the roller coasters are, but you know the ones I'm talking about. But a lesser version. Let me back up a minute. Bipolar 1 is just the mania. Bipolar 2 is where you cycle between mania, the very serious kind, and depression. And then cyclothymia is a lesser version of number 2. Okay, so let's go back. What is depressive? What are some of the depressive symptoms? Well, there's a word that used to be used a lot called melancholia. Have you ever heard of that? Somebody's melancholy.
Yes.
It's just a feeling that they're never quite happy. You know, things that would make most people happy, a this or a that, you know, a smile or somebody loves them or this. The person with depression doesn't feel that with the same kinds of things coming toward them in a good way. They may have trouble sleeping. Often it means they just don't want to do anything else except sleep. But sometimes it means that they'll go to sleep and then they keep waking up and they can't sleep. So it can be either one. It's sleep problems. Another symptom of depression is the things that normally used to make them happy. You know, maybe they like to run track, and that normally used to do it for them. They can go out and take a run in the morning or in the evening, and they were good to go. And now it doesn't do it, and they don't even want to do it. Mm-hmm. So whatever it was that they used to really enjoy doing, they no longer enjoy doing.
Or play music or whatever.
Yeah, it's just not the same anymore. And they may still try to do it, but it feels more like a burden. Things that used to make them happy no longer make them happy during the depressive episode. And and then there's also a relationship to food. For many people, they will either stop eating and they'll lose weight, or they will turn to food to try to be happy. You know, they'll eat foods that normally would give them a little bit of a rise in energy or a rise in temperament or mood, and it's not helping.
Right.
So when somebody becomes severely depressed, it's not just feeling down. It's not just melancholy. When somebody is severely depressed, they, and you may have heard me say this at one time before, but when I've seen it in person, it's pretty amazing. Severe depression, you can actually see it in somebody's musculature, in their face. Their face
yep.
just doesn't have that alive look anymore. Literally, the muscles sag. Now, I'm not talking about aging.
No, they feel heavier. Everything
yeah.
about them just feels heavier.
And when they walk or when they move, it's like lead. And some
yeah.
people will actually describe that feeling as if they are encased in lead. Now that,
mud or...
Yeah, that's severe depression. Now, the interesting thing about the most severe depression is that people generally are not suicidal in the most severe depression because they don't have the energy to do it. So if they
yeah.
get treated, when do you have to worry?
Wow.
When they're coming out.
When they're coming right out of it? Or?
That's exactly right. When a person has been suffering from severe depression, so severe that they just can't, they don't have the energy to get up and try to kill themselves or anything else, and then they start getting some help, maybe they get therapy or maybe they get some medication that's starting to work, it usually takes a few weeks, but they still haven't done the therapeutic work to change their thinking patterns. So they're starting to feel more energy, but they're still feeling hopeless and helpless. That's when they're most likely to be suicidal.
And people would have their guard down because they think that they're getting help, and so they're in a better place.
Yes.
So they may not watch them as close because they're
right.
seeing improvement.
That's right. And that's when I become most concerned about people.
Right.
You know, it does tend to run in families. So if you live in a family where there have been other people who have suffered from depression or bipolar, and
yep.
you know, you've either heard it through the family stories or you've witnessed it yourself, there's a greater chance that you could also suffer from it. It doesn't mean that you will, and there are steps you can take to prevent it. And I'd like to go over some of those steps. But first, before I do that, I just want to find out if you're feeling comfortable with what I've said so far about what depression looks like.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. How about you, Mel?
Oh, I'm definitely feeling comfortable with it, and I like everything that's been said so far. I think it's important to get out there.
I'm comfortable with it, mind you. Okay, I think it is. It's very clear, and I hope.
Yeah.
You know, it would be nice if our listeners are taking notes and keeping tabs on it, because if there is somebody going through this, and it is a terrible disease. Depression is absolutely
yeah.
terrible.
Yeah.
I hope that people are taking notes, and if they're going through any of this or know somebody who is, that they will seek help. Very important.
Right.
Thank you, Nadine, for the information there.
You're welcome, and it is so important. I think, I imagine that every single person is touched by depression, if not bipolar, at some point in their lives. They may not know that that's what's going on. They may just think it's a very super talkative person or just a person that's kind of a stick in the mud, doesn't want to ever go out. But when you see a person who has been, if you've known them for a long time, and they have been energetic and they have been involved socially and so forth, and then something happens and they stop doing those things. Now, it could be environmental. In other words, maybe somebody close to them died okay? And there's a normal grieving that goes through after that. But this is one of the differences between normal grieving and depression. Usually when a person grieves because they've lost something important, it could be a marriage, it could be a child, it could be a, you know, somebody in their lives, I mean a child through custody, you know, certainly through death.
Mm-hmm.
But they still have a sense of self-esteem. In depression, the person's self-esteem takes a nosedive. And that's the biggest difference. So if you see somebody who's gone through a loss and they still seem to be pulling back and spending time by themselves and not coming out and being with other people, and you talk to them and you find out their self-esteem is in the mud, that's when to be concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Because that may be a person who has the grieving has become what's called complicated, and now they are in a depressed state. Now, one of the most serious times for depression is after a baby's born, a couple of weeks after a baby's born, and that's very much biological, but it's also psychological. Hormones have just gone kind of crazy with the birth of the baby and so forth, but then also who that woman was prior to giving birth, even if she has other children, prior to giving birth, and then 2 weeks later when she finds herself literally tied if she's breastfeeding with the breast, you know. I mean, she's no longer who she was. And that's not to say that it's not a wonderful, beautiful thing to have a baby and to do all those things, but it does take an adjustment, just like the death of a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so depression can hit really hard during those times. And lately, in the past decade or so, we've been hearing of more and more women who have been doing unbelievable, what seemed to be unbelievable acts where they would actually kill their own babies.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're not paying close enough attention to what's going on with some of these people in our society and how they may be suffering, and we just don't even know it. We think that they should be happy.
Right.
And they
right.
And when they first had the baby, they probably were. And they, you know, everybody thinks everything's cool. But then 2 weeks later, when that woman is by herself and nobody's
right.
lending a hand, that's when she may be in trouble. So when we're talking about depression, and as I said, there's so much about it, we could talk about it at another time. And we're talking about a cycle between depression and mania. That's bipolar 2, and it's very serious. And if somebody talks about killing themselves or if they're exhibiting all these signs, including low self-esteem, poor concentration, or difficulty making decisions, and feelings of hopelessness, those are all key to, if that's a friend of yours or a family member, put your arm around them and take them in for some help.
Nadine,
yes.
I'd like to cut in with a very important question here, because
mm-hmm.
when somebody speaks about suicide and somebody says or even hints at it, like, you know what, I'm not worth anything, I'm no good, I'm not good for anything, that is something to keep an eye on. Now, how about the cases, and this is going to be a tough one, but I think you are more than able to handle this question, Nadine. I believe this.
Well, thank you, David. We'll see.
Well, that's true. And I'm not laughing, okay? This is the truth, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But on a serious note, a person suddenly becomes energetic. A person is going out of his or her way to do whatever they can to accomplish many things.
Mm-hmm.
They're starting to give stuff
wow.
away. And saying, hey, here's a gift for you. Hey, no, I don't. No, please, it's a pleasure. Here, take this. And suddenly, there's such an exuberant manifestation of generosity, and almost almost a manic kind of behavior. Then suddenly, a week later, you're reading this person or hearing this person took his life.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
I would get worried.
But people don't. Once again, people are they tend not to observe these things.
I would connect that.
If somebody has been, you know, if you know them well, and if you don't know them well, then you don't necessarily know these things that are going on in their private life.
Right.
But if you know them well enough to know that they've been pulling back, spending more time alone, et cetera, and then for some unknown reason, all of a sudden they start divesting themselves of things in their life.
Right.
That's when I get very concerned, because this looks like a suicide about to happen.
Right.
Because one of the things that happens often when somebody is thinking about killing themselves and they're just feeling so low that they think that the world would be better without them, and then all of a sudden they start having, and they think, okay, well, then that's what I'm going to do. The irony is that all of a sudden they feel energized. Now they've made this decision.
Right.
And so, but they don't want to go and just leave everything, you know, in disarray, and so they may actually start giving things away.
Right.
That would be a big alarm bell going off if I saw that with somebody.
Right.
I would really want to sit down with them and spend some real good time with them and get them help. You know, sometimes, you know, we might think we're seeing something, but we're not sure, and we have
right.
to just ask. We have to ask. And are you thinking about killing yourself? Now, chances are that person, if they're not wanting anybody to know, they may laugh it off and say, oh, no, of course not. But I wouldn't laugh with them.
Or probably say something like, are you crazy? Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Me?
Right.
No,
I have
no
so much to live for. Why would I do something like that?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And if I have enough concern that I ask the question and they come back with a flippant answer,
right,
that's when I want to hang out and just notice, because it could be that they're just fine.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe they've just decided to clean house.
Right.
But, again, if you notice, what I said was they had been pulling back for a while before this change. And so that's one of the things to look for is, what has their behavior been the past few months or the past year? Or did they lose somebody so important that they feel like there's nothing left to live for? You know, all of those are things to look for. Now, let's talk specifically about cyclothymia, because cyclothymia,
right,
like bipolar 2, it has both the manic, in this case it's called hypomania. And hypomania, as I mentioned before, is a less intense version of manic episode. So instead of being in the jet plane, you're in the crop duster. So you're still going plenty fast, and your life may feel a little out of control, but you still have some sense that you can handle it. And so the cyclothymia is, there's a cycle, that's why it says cyclo. Cyclothymia, the thymic, we're really looking at dysthymia would be only depression. So the cyclothymia means that there's depression and hypomania. Now, the irony about that is that some of the most successful people in the world suffered from hypothymia. They were hypothymic because they're going, you know, fast, like in an airplane, not so fast like a jet that they can't see anything that's going on, and so they tend to be very productive during those highs. And if they are able to deal with the depression, they may struggle through it. It may be hard for them, but somehow they manage to get through it. And so some people live a life where they are dealing with cyclothymia and they don't realize it, but life feels harder for them. And for these people, if you were to give somebody with cyclothymia or even with bipolar 2 an antidepressant, you might kill them.
Oh.
Because if they go into a manic state and then they have an antidepressant, which means that it's going to have them feel better, they may just go right over the top. So for a person with cyclothymia, and I'm not a psychiatrist and I'm not trying to prescribe here, so I just want to be real clear about that. Just telling you some information. But a person with cyclothymia I would encourage them to ask their doctor, specifically a psychiatrist, because they're the ones trained in these medications, to ask them about a mood stabilizer. Now, many years ago, when I first started doing this work in the 70s, and well, I guess 82 was when I first started professionally, with guys coming back from Vietnam, we didn't have good medications back then. I mean, you know, there was almost nothing, and they had lots of side effects. And I, for one, was really not in favor of people taking medication if there was any way we could do it clinically, you know, by talking therapies. Now, though, there are some pretty good medications out there. And if somebody is suffering from bipolar in any regard, then I strongly encourage them to do two things. Well, actually, three. Four, I'm going to add to it. One is to definitely see a medical doctor, preferably a psychiatrist, and let them know what they suspect and why. Because if they need a medication, that would be the person I would go to for the medication. Number two, I would encourage them to get therapy, because even the, as I said before, you can get a medication that will start to give you more energy, but if you're still saying to yourself, I feel hopeless and helpless about the state of the world or the state of my family or myself, then you could still be suicidal. So not only medication, a mood stabilizer in the case of cyclothymia, I would suggest that the person ask about, but also psychotherapy, working with somebody. Now, in years past, we were able to do that with family members and community. And for heaven's sakes, if you have a really talented friend or family member who will really stay with you and help you feel good about yourself, go for it. But if you don't suffer alone, because it's too dangerous for you and for others. And then number three, exercise. Now, the most amazing thing is there have been some studies done that show that exercise in and of itself makes it much more difficult for the brain to fall into a depressive or manic state. I won't get into all the specifics of how that works, but just know that exercise is wonderful. So whether it's taking a walk, you know, a brisk walk a couple of times or once a day, or going to a gym, or you know, beating on the drums and or having sex, whatever it is, get that exercise every day. And then the fourth one is this, and this is by way of prevention. If you ever hear yourself saying, I feel hopeless about fill in the blank, or I feel helpless to do anything about it, stop it. Stop right then and there.
Good
advice. You may even have to say out loud to yourself, stop it. Let it go. Because there is nothing so important as a human life, all the potential and all the possibility that that could bring to our world, for that person to become so hopeless and helpless that they would take their own lives.
Right on.
And that's a biggie. In terms of what do we do that creates depression, well, if we sit like a lump and don't eat right and don't exercise, that will definitely contribute to it. If we drink alcohol, that's a depressant. If we have an undiagnosed, and this is where we get into a couple of the other ones, if we have an undiagnosed medical condition like hypothymia, low thyroid, I mean not thymia, low thyroid, then that can contribute to depression. There are a number of medical disorders that can lead to depression. That's another reason for going to your doctor. I mean, I suffered with depression for many years, and I finally found an endocrinologist who said, you've got Hashimoto's disease. You've got such low thyroid that it's causing depression. I went, well, hallelujah.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's a medical thing. And, you know as much as anybody, David, how much the Native American community has been affected by diet over the past 50, 100 years that subsidies have been given to people that are very unhealthy. I mean, the subsidies are unhealthy. It's basically flour and sugar and a few other things. And so there's a very high incidence of diabetes, and along with that comes depression.
Right.
Right.
And so, it's hard when you're part of a collective history of genocide to pull out of that your own personal, like, depression, because you can explain it away with, well, because different people are coming at me, or the racism or the environment, it's making me feel this way, when it could actually be a medical condition separate from mm-hmm. the external events.
You're absolutely right, Nell. And there's been research done, and I know it's true for people in our own Native communities, but there's actually been some research done on the European Holocaust as opposed to the American Holocaust, which
mm-hmm.
we'll talk about sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And the European Holocaust with the Jewish people, the people who survived it, but they had horrible losses, family members and so forth, and, you know, came to this country and other countries where they tried to make a life for themselves. There was so much trauma and so much loss that
right.
there was something called secondary PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's where the children of these people suffered from stress reactions or post-traumatic stress, not because they had personally been imprisoned, but because they were brought up by somebody who was so traumatized by it that they brought it into their children's lives. Now, I think,
mm-hmm.
and Nell, I think what you were just saying is that in many of our communities, and particularly in our Native communities, but also in other
mm-hmm.
communities,
yes.
perhaps even in the African-American communities, there have been people in family members who have struggled, who have been through horrible abuse, psychologically, if not also physically, and it becomes cultural at a certain level.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
the way to pull out of it is, you know, some of these things we have to really take a look at how we can pull all of us out of it is one at a time.
Right, cultural
and
depression.
Yeah, and start looking, you know, find out physically what can you do to make yourself feel better and not suffer from depression, so that you will have the energy to reach out and take the hand of another person and help them too.
Yeah.
And then they will have the energy to take the hand of another person and help them too. Because my belief is that that's the way we all get out of this stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Very well put.
Well, this is some powerful stuff because
yeah.
I've had the honor of meeting a number of European Holocaust survivors,
mm-hmm.
and as an indigenous man of Turtle Island, I deal with my own cultural PTSD. Mm-hmm. You know, saying, okay, what's going to become of our people? I even wrote a song about it,
mm-hmm.
And these wonderful people. Of having survived the concentration camps had given me strength and given me such hope and such encouragement as
yeah.
well. And
yeah.
I have such a deep love and such a deep respect for these
yeah.
wonderful people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And David, you see how they did it? Hopeful as opposed to hopeless.
Right.
That word carries more power than most people have any idea. Because when we begin to slide into that slippery slope of feeling hopeless, that's when we begin to lose control of our own lives, but also of everybody we love.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the people who came from the Holocaust and have learned to become hopeful and to fight against the things that would pull them down are wonderful examples, and I mentioned, I think last time we talked, Viktor Frankl is one of those people. He wrote Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah.
And he went through the concentration camps, and he talked about how important it was for him to create meaning when there was none.
Right.
Wow.
Or at least he couldn't find any, so he created meaning. And I think in our own indigenous communities, it's so important for us to look at how we can bring meaning instead of just suffering over and over what happened. You know, I think anybody who knows the atrocities and the horror of all that, but to keep going over it with our children at some level is not helping them pull out.
Well, there is an added dimension, Nadine, and I say this with a lot of love and with all respect. I think part of the continuing process of depression among the indigenous peoples here in Canada and in Central South Turtle Island and in the Caribbean islands, where a lot of people don't seem to understand, they are Native Americans too. They are indigenous of Turtle Island. People
right.
from Puerto Rico and Cuba and Haiti, Santo Domingo, or Quisqueya, and South Turtle Island, the perpetuation of genocidal attempts continues, and it's not just the attitudes of our fathers and our grandfathers or our grandmothers and grandmothers, but it is also a continuing active practice in Turtle Island to perpetuate this state of depression and hopelessness. It's what I call hope with grease poured on it. You try to hold on to it, but somebody poured grease on it, and it just slips right through. The tales of suicide among the indigenous peoples has been astronomically high, higher than the mainstream could ever know. A lot of the bad things that happen to Native peoples on Turtle Island, nobody knows about. Nobody.
And David, you're so right. I mean, you're absolutely right, because things do continue to happen. And the thing that they happened with the man crossing the street, Mr. Williams, in Seattle, where he was shot, and all he was doing, he was a carver. And there was that family in Nevada, and they were chased down and beaten up horribly, and then they were arrested. I mean, there are terrible things that still happen that so many people in this country do not know of that indigenous people are having to suffer through. So you're absolutely right, and I forgive me if it sounded like I was implying that it's just something from the past, because I know it's not. However, what we do need to do is, given that there is still so much negativity going on, we don't want to compound it. In other words, somehow, and it's not easy. It's a very complicated thing, and I don't have the answers. But
I know
that working together, we're coming up with pieces of it. But somehow it's important that we, encourage our young people to learn the traditional ways, that we encourage our people to, of all cultures, not just indigenous cultures, to take back value in human life and in nature, and stop allowing, everyone, if they could see that this is really their brother or their sister, and stop allowing other people to abuse their brothers and sisters, we just got to pull this together. So
that's important to see. Absolutely. Nadine, you just touched on something very important. Because, we are talking about serious psychiatric, psychological disorders. And I think that there, in many cases, and maybe I'm off the wall here, but we do have hormonal and chemical things going on inside, which I believe can be exacerbated by outside influences. And one thing that does disturb me is the intertribal bickering that goes on. You guys are an Indian. You don't deserve this. We have our casino. We have our money. You guys can starve. I have to say it, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I'm going to offend somebody. But this intertribal bickering and demeaning of our fellow indigenous also perpetuates the problem, and it's something that we need to address and need to stop.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, and I think that you're bringing up such wonderful points, David. Now, the bickering, when you think about the origins of the tribes, these are different nations, and not all nations agree. And so the fact that so many people are trying to pull together is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And the fact that they're still bickering, it's something to be overcome, but it's at least people are trying. you know, and maybe we can find some ways to get rid of the bickering, because one of the things that you did say, and I agree with it, you know, maybe there's something chemical going on. One of the symptoms of depression is irritability. And irritability leads to bickering. So if I'm looking at some, you know, I'm experiencing depression, and I don't realize I'm not bipolar, I'm not this, I'm not that. But sometimes that bickering is a symptom of not feeling good physically or being scared of letting go emotionally.
That's true.
And so we just have to keep hanging on, you know, I mean, hanging in there with each other. I'm sorry, now what were you saying?
Well, one thing that I see with a lot of people, like you said, it could be hereditary. So within a family, I can see three or four different people in that family that are cycling at different pieces of it and destroying the hell out of each other. And so it's very difficult within the context of that family to realize what is the broader picture is of mental health when you're so used to pure chaos and ripping each other to shreds because everyone is in their own form of cycling. So it's a hard thing to live with.
Well, and I, you know, I would hope that if somebody in a family were to recognize that that was going on, that they would be brave enough to get some help for themselves.
Right.
Because if one person changes, the rest cannot remain the same.
Exactly.
If one person changes, the rest cannot remain the same. And that's why I believe that in the larger scope of things, each one of us is so important. If one of us changes and refuses to buy into the hate and refuses to buy into the bickering and just moves through it as lovingly as we can, firmly, lovingly, whatever, but then others cannot stay the same. You know, it takes that old thing, it takes two to tango. Well, it does. It takes more than one person. And I said way back at the beginning of the interview, sometimes I'll watch online and I'll see this person saying this and this person saying this. And I can see how it got there. And what I choose to do is just simply stay fast, stand fast, and not run away from it. So far, I've been able to do that, but I understand that's not always possible.
I'm still working on that.
Hey, Mel, am I ever irritable? Don't answer.
No, you're adorable. Just adorable.
But Mel, nobody ever said it would be easy. And
well,
if they did, they were lying.
One thing I see is that the impulse decisions that people make had created ripple effects. So they're trying to get well while also undoing the damage that they did when they weren't well. And it seems to be a constant chasing of, let me fix this that was that I broke. Okay, that's getting better. Oh, no, I broke something again. So it's a constant fixing and unfixing. So it's very difficult just to stop the energy of it and to stop creating the next ripple effect.
Yeah, and that word, stop, is the key.
Right.
That is actually a therapeutic technique, and that is if I keep trying to fix something that I broke, I'm going to constantly be fixing because every one of us have broken stuff.
Right.
And I have to, at some point, I have to let go of trying to fix things and just let it be and try to change myself. And that's it. Stop being hopeless and helpless and you know, looking at the possibility of the situation instead of just the worst that could happen. I mean, it, every one of us could look at the worst, and sometimes we do. But if we can at least some of the time make a conscious effort to get beyond the worst and say, I refuse, I'm going to stop being hopeless about this. And I don't know the answer. But by George, together I believe that we will do it. And you two are a prime example. You're wonderful. You know, what you were doing. I mean, you know. And Russ, I mean, and there are others. I mean, I am so blessed to know you.
Oh.
Right back at you, Nadine. You're a blessing.
Oh boy, I think it might be coming to an end now.
I do have one call that I'd like to get on the air.
Okay.
So hold on just a second. Let me see. Paul, are you there?
Hi, Nell. How are you going?
All right. How are you doing? Welcome.
I'm doing
to the
well,
show.
Thanks. Thank you.
Paul's been adding so much in the chat room that I wanted to give him a moment to speak as well.
Oh, sure. Paul?
Hey, welcome in, Paul. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I've been chatting with Nell on in the chat blog area there. Look, I was just interested, totally fascinated in the subject, and I was interested in the percentage of, you've spoken a bit about physical conditioning that leads towards depression, and I'm wondering if you had any statistical or percentage basis versus trauma-induced depression?
No, I don't. I'm sorry that I don't. You're. Let me make sure I hear your question. You're wondering if there's some percentage of trauma-induced depression. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, versus a physical condition.
Yeah. No, I don't have that information. But this is what I do believe. I believe that regardless of how we got here, you know, to feel depressed or
mm-hmm.
have these cycles, that the ways to get out of it are pretty much the same. In other words, we know that we have shifted something that's going on in our brains, and that the hippocampus, the memory center, is affected, and that one of the things that happens with trauma specifically is that we become hyper alert after that. And if we combine the hyper alertness along with depressive feelings and so forth, then that's a recipe for disaster. So what I would like to suggest is find somebody that can help with the trauma. I would do that first.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm diagnosed rapid cycling bipolar 2.
Uh-huh.
And probably diagnosed maybe 15 years ago. Unmanaged, it was wreaking havoc on my family and my whole life. However, I've probably, I guess now, maybe 8 years, managed it and managing it very well. And that only... That situation only came about purely and simply through complete understanding of my situation, and another big factor was realistically having somebody close to me that understood it as well, that could, you can't see it when you're in it.
Yeah.
And to have somebody looking inside the window at your behaviour and pulling you back and pointing things out to you is a great indicator as well. So... I was medicated for possibly 7 years, I guess, and that to me was just a perilous situation to be in as well, because I felt comatose, and I'd lost all my creativity, and once even the side effects to the medication, the addiction to the medication in itself is life-threatening, I believe. So to manage it without any drugs, I just feel probably in the best position that I've ever been in. But I can look back. I've got the privilege of being able to look back on it and know that it's a double-edged sword. When you're in your heights, you can conquer the world. And when you're in your lows, it's a life-threatening situation.
Yeah.
However, to manage that and manage it well, it is workable, and you can live with it, and you can make it work for you.
Paul, I appreciate so much what you're saying, and I couldn't agree with you more. As I said many years ago when I first started in this work as a psychologist, and before that as a counselor, there weren't good medications, and so the work was very much person to person.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the fact that you have somebody in your life that is able to see in that window is just a blessing. I wish we all did. And to the extent we do, then our chances of recovery are much greater. For those who don't, or even if they do sometimes, if they're in the height of it, then they may need some more help. But without that talking therapy, without talking, sitting and talking with somebody and learning different ways of thinking and carrying ourselves in the world, in other words, creating a new perception of who we are in the world, the medication by itself just won't do, in my opinion, just won't do the trick.
Yeah, and look, I totally understand that. I think me personally, the time in my life when medication for me at the time was the only solution.
Yeah.
To stabilize
myself.
Well,
it kept you alive.
It saved my life. However, more understanding and cognitive therapy for me was just fantastic. And look, this it stemmed from childhood trauma that is going to be with me to the day I die, but it's how you reflect on it. And I was also interested in your comments about cultural depression, because I do circulate with many people from a similar childhood background as mine, which is similar to the problems that are over there in Canada as well with the Indian population.
Sounds like Ireland that you're talking about.
Yeah,
Australia, actually.
Yeah.
Australia, yes, of course.
One of the activists helping the fight for the children's rights, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the Forgotten Australians. So institutionalized children and things like that, and the things that were harmed. Yeah, we were harmed by churches and government and that sort of thing as well. Look, all that, and it's a legacy of that outcome, but you can certainly, in the areas that I circulate, you can certainly see the cultural depression that exists within people affected and the propensity to continue that lifestyle, that it's difficult to break that cycle. And I just said to Nell a bit earlier, you know, it's like you've got to burst the bubble of depression. You've got to break out of it.
That's
and
right.
I think your mind is the only thing that's going to empower you to do that. And but it doesn't come, it's not just as though you can switch a switch on and say, I don't choose to do this anymore. You have to manage it. So there will be days where you don't want to get out of bed. There'll be days where you'll talk the leg off a chair. You'll be Superman. and you've just got to manage them. And you've got to be aware of how you're behaving and what you're doing. I mean, I've had the days, you know, it was interesting. I'd get paid on get my monthly salary and I'd go on a bender for 2 days.
Yeah.
And the devastation that caused back then was just horrific to everybody. Now, when you say that you've got a soulmate around you and somebody to cater for that, the toll that it takes on people around you in your life at the time is just as horrendous, where you may have burnt every bridge that you ever had. So many people may find that they're completely alone with it. And I think that's a big thing that is really quite important with the subject as well.
Right on.
You know, what you're describing is, in terms of bursting the bubble of depression, in a way it's really like going through a death. And when somebody loses someone close to them, that person dies, they have to reorganize who they are in the absence of that person. Well, bursting the bubble of depression in many ways is reorganizing who we are in the absence of that grieving that we have done from the trauma.
Yep.
Exactly.
And you, congratulations. I'm so glad you're on the planet. I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. And thank you so very much for calling in.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I'm glad to have you on, Paul. Absolutely. This has been a really good discussion. I think this is very, very informative and very important because I think we've covered a lot of areas that affect so many people. And I think one of the important messages is that we work together to help each other.
Yes.
Because, you know,
right.
No one's an island, and we really need to pay attention and care for one
exactly.
another.
Exactly. We have to be aware of what's going on, and we have to care about what's going on. And then
in the activist circles that are fighting for child abuse, and they're mm-hmm. exposed to a high level of it, we mm-hmm. need to monitor them even closer because, mm-hmm. you know,
absolutely.
Even if you're not there, you can be triggered a hell of a lot easier if you're exposed mm-hmm. to constant articles of this and that. So we all
mm-hmm.
need to make sure and check each other's energy and make sure everybody's in a good place.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me on, Nell and David and Russ, wherever you are.
Yeah, we're going to be doing more shows coming up with you because we just love everything that you're saying, and we want to get this information out with someone with your spirit because
I
think it'll
that.
Speak to these children and these people who have lived so much.
Well, I appreciate it, and I feel the same way about you and that you've had me on, and I just hope that I am able to help in some small way.
Absolutely. Before you go, though, I'm also reading your book. Would you mind telling us the title of your book? Because I recommend
yes.
it to everyone.
Oh, thank you. The name of the book is called Native Land, Lost in the Mystery of Time. And essentially it's about a woman who spent her lifetime searching for her lost family.
Right.
And finally found them. And then all hell breaks loose.
All hell. And we have a lot of people who are searching for their families out there. And this, they'll completely understand what's written in the book. So I hope
yeah.
they read it and enjoy it as much as I am.
Well, isn't it true that they're going to, you're working on making the book into a movie?
Yes, we are working very hard on that. And, you know, we've been working on a business plan and we're working with a person in marketing to try to get that out to investors. And, you know, that's the biggie right now. I mean, we could make it tomorrow if we had the money. But as with everything else, it takes shekels.
Yes, it does.
Nadine, do you have a website that you can share with our listeners in case people want to learn a little more about it?
Sure. The website is actually similar to the name of the book, and it's called Native Land Productions. .com. That's it, NativeLandProductions.com.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank
that,
you.
I would like to thank our wonderful friend and guest, Dr. Nadine Vaughn Williams. Keep an eye out for that book. It's a wonderful book, and I can't wait to see the movie. I want to thank Nell. As always, what an awesome person and great person to work with, a wonderful person. And she's our producer, and kudos, hats off to you, Mel. Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, our listening audience, I want to thank you so much for tuning in to Fire Talk. Many blessings to you, my friends. Walk in peace and walk in beauty. Tok Shaki.
And keep each other safe.
Aho.
Aho.
Oh, why you look so sad? The tears are in your eyes. Come on and come to me. I've seen the dark side too.